Hi, I'm Eunice Oladejo, and this is Policy Talks. In this episode, I sit down with security consultant and national security instructor, Huda McBill, who discusses her journey from intelligence to politics and how her dedication to challenging institutional racism and advocating for equitable representation in national security has shaped her career and experiences. Huda McBill is a Canadian author, academic, and national security consultant. As a Black woman, Huda stands as a trailblazer in the field of national security, actively combating structural racism and serving as an exemplary model of resilience. With an impressive career spanning over 18 years, Huda has held key roles as a senior intelligence officer at the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, or CSIS, and as a strategic national security advisor for the Canada Border Service Agency, or CBSA. Her expertise extends to domestic and international counterterrorism and counterintelligence investigations within the Five Eye Alliance. Notably, her exceptional contributions to the investigation of the 2005 London terrorist attacks earned her recognition and awards from the British Security Service, MI5. Huda's book, Agent of Change, My Life Fighting Terrorists, Spies, and Institutional Racism, received the first place honor in the Hill Times newspaper for 2023. Currently, she serves as an instructor of national security at the Professional Development Institute at the University of Ottawa. Huda is devoted to advancing social justice and addressing issues such as gender discrimination, anti-Black racism, Islamophobia, and various forms of intersectional injustice. Thank you, Huda, for being with us today. A brief reminder to our followers and listeners that all opinions discussed today are reflective of the individual person expressing them and do not reflect the views of the interviewer, IFRS Canada, the Canadian Foreign Policy Journal, or the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs. Now let's dive into the show. Well, thank you so much, Huda, for joining us today, and I was present at your Canada Talks event a few weeks back and really enjoyed your talk, and so I'm excited to be having further conversations based off of that and also just your general work and life experiences. So to start off, can you tell us a little bit about your work trajectory and what led you to a public service career?
It's really amazing to be with you. You know, Carleton University holds a really special place in my heart as a graduate, as an alumni. And it was great to be invited to come and speak with students there. In terms of what got me into a career in national security, it really all started at Carleton University. I was seeking my honors in law. And I was taking a course in national security, a professor approached me and asked in terms of my background and the languages that I speak, and recommended a career in national security. So that's how I began the application process. And of course, this is year 2000, and so CSIS did not have a website where you can apply as you can today. So I sent in my application and received a reply shortly after and began that process. And you know, yes, I was looking for a career, but I also really wanted to do something that had global impact. So international security was something that I was really passionate about, as well as public safety as a student of law. And it felt like a perfect fit in terms of a career choice for me.
Kind of off of that, I'm curious to, and we'll talk about later on as we go through the questions, your time at CSIS and then running for public office. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what your motivations were behind getting involved or working within CSIS and then also with your eventual run for public office.
Yeah, so working for CSIS for almost 16 years, 2 months short, I had become aware of many things, policy issues that I was concerned about in terms of national security, where we were going with that. The year 2015 to 17 is where we were really discussing Bill C-51 and increasing that kind of surveillance securitization that I saw progress throughout my career. I was really concerned about that. I was also concerned about equity laws here in Canada. We had the Employment Equity Act that we had not updated for so many years. And, you know, given the fact that I faced discrimination myself, it allowed me to step back, look at the laws themselves and what needed to be changed and updated. And that got me interested. But it was really through my work with the Black Class Action Secretariat. So there is a 1,500 Black public service employees, current and former, who are suing the government for the discrimination throughout their career in the public sector. And in connecting with them, working for them, interviewing so many of the people that have been impacted by this, I felt there was a real need for legislative changes. And the only way, really, the shortcut to do that, as opposed to being an activist, to really get into Parliament and advocate for those changes. And so that's what led me into politics.
And so we're going to kind of go into more specifics on your time at CSIS. And during the Canada Talks event, you talked about being one of the few first Black women in CSIS, the first Black Arab Canadian Muslim intelligence officer, and then also at one point the only Arabic speaker. And so obviously that's amazing accomplishments, and I know being the first or being like some of the onlys might have also had an impact on your experience within the department. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how that impacted your time in the department, kind of going in and not seeing people before you that looked like you.
Yeah, you know, it was a great privilege for me to have entered this field. I know that people have been excluded from working in national security in terms of the way that the nation was structured. You know, Indigenous people were prevented, Black people were prevented, other racialized people only let in years 2000. So we had, in terms of women, we had the first intelligence officers in 1984 at CSIS. That's not too long ago. And then women or Black racialized people in year 2000, which is shocking to so many people that I talk to, that in Canada it took that long for people to enter this workplace. And, you know, when you're going through it, you don't realize just the responsibility that comes with, right? And it was an interesting journey that I wouldn't change for the world, but it came with me having to fight structural and systemic issues in the workplace. And to a greater extent, I went through a lot of the internal grievances. I went through complaint after complaint, and things weren't progressing to the way that I wanted them to. Now, my entrance also was not just that I'm a racialized and woman in a place that is structured to be mostly for a white male and certain socioeconomic backgrounds. There is the timing that I went in was right after September 11. And so we had Islamophobia just starting to happen in these workplaces as well as other places, but more so, I would say, in the security sector. So it was, a challenging times to be, to have those identities within me and to be in those environments. And I think I did a really good job doing the work, so contributing to national security, and also challenging the organization, which is part of why I wrote my book, Agent of Change, My Life Fighting Terrorist Spies and Institutional Racism, because I had to do it all, all at once.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned in that in your previous statement, but in during the Canada Talks event, you also talked about how unique of an experience it was being in CSIS post 9/11. And so I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit more to this and how you were navigating your work, or just even like the work culture within CSIS following 9/11.
So I was, you know, I was in training until 2002, and then was placed in the counterterrorism Middle East desk, which was really the at the forefront of fighting the threat of counterterrorism in Canada. And the government at the time, we had legislative changes that came about, our first Anti-Terrorism Act. And so CSIS was also at the forefront of pretty much educating or leading other security sectors. So the border agencies, the RCMP began to have its own INSET division, which was focused on counterterrorism. And so there was a lot of preparedness that needed to be done. And so being part of that for me was, you know, being able to contribute at that level at something that really mattered was incredibly amazing. But there was that noticeable lack of expertise in understanding the global threat. There was deficiency in linguistic, cultural knowledge, and ways of engaging with racialized and religious communities. And I think those are things that we continue to work on, and lots of mistakes have happened in the past, you know, about the Meher Abrar inquiry and other inquiries that really demonstrated that these organizations lacked that kind of expertise and had a lot of bias in the work that they did. And so it was, you know, navigating all of that. But in terms of culture, CSIS originates from the RCMP. So CSIS was created in 1983-84, and it was as a result of wrongdoings within the RCMP security service. But the problem in terms of culture is that we had former Mounties that just took off their uniforms, entered CSIS, and brought the culture with them. And so the culture was very much like police types of cultures, like hierarchy, kind of male misogyny was acceptable in the workplace. And that makes for a culture that is that is problematic to work in, let alone the fact that if you're racialized, you're pretty much on your own. So the only racialized person in any meeting, in any kind of decision making, and so really challenging times at such a like at so many different levels.
What was the turning point within that time that then led to the class action lawsuit? So as you know, were working within CSIS, was there a point where then it really became apparent, like, okay, I do need to be involved within this lawsuit? What did that look like?
Yeah, after 16 years and almost 16, I had went through a lot of the grievance processes within the organization and found them to be deficient. And so because, you know, there are the policies are there that, you know, you shouldn't discriminate and so on. But the culture made it really difficult to impact change. And I went through different competitions. And after about the seventh one, you know, I walked into an office knowing that I was not going to get this promotion, which I was deserving, and found the interviewers to be people who lacked the kind of expertise or the kind of experiences that I've had being at the forefront of what the organization did. And so I felt there was more at play here than, you know, the more at play in terms of barriers for career progression and to be in a position to really impact change at a higher level. But it wasn't only that. It was the fact that I was seeing other racialized people and women also like low morale within the organization. A lot of people were, at, you know, after that 15, 16 year career mark, were leaving the sector and seeking employment in the private sector. And it really took myself and four other people. So the first Black woman, a gay man, and two other Muslim officers out of the Toronto region. We came together and realized, you know, this is, we're fighting something systemic. We can't individually do this. And we needed to go public because the organization itself wasn't prepared to acknowledge that those things existed in the workplace. And so that's exactly what we did. We filed the lawsuit. You know, I had, there were so many risks in doing that. So the risks were the fact that, you know, you've been living on in the shadows for so many years. So going public with my story was something that was unimaginable to me as an officer. And you know, the work that we do is dangerous. We recruit sources, we talk to people, and there's always that risk that somebody's upset with thesis and will come, you know. And so there is, like, you know, you have to consider your own safety, your family's safety, as well as career-wise. You know, you sue your employer, it's really difficult to get back into the workplace. And so many risks that we had to take so that we are able to bring this issue, which is really important, to the forefront of discussion in Canada. I was really, really pleased with the fact that the Prime Minister commented on the first day that the lawsuit went public and said it was unacceptable that there would be this kind of culture at CSIS, as well as the Public Safety Minister. It came up in the House of Commons. And so the fact that it generated this discussion was really amazing. It also, on the inside of CSIS, forced change. So what CSIS did was hire an outside third-party consulting firm that looked at the workplace and produced a report that talked about it's called the Climate Assessment Report. And it talked about the role morale, the lack of diversity, the culture that is so problematic. Someone said it was a place that progress had forgotten. You know, so it brought to light these issues, and it forced the organization to do something it didn't do with other inquiries, public inquiries and other things. It made them admit for the very first time that they have a systemic issues in the workplace, that there is a toxic work culture where bullying and harassment and all of this has been going on. And I think that solving a problem, it takes, you know, it's acknowledging and recognizing the problem is not only the first step towards change, but it's really half the problem. Identifying solutions comes next, but if you don't know what problems you have, or you want to shove it under the rug, or you don't want to deal with it or admit it, that's where the organization was prior to what myself and the group of other officers did.
Yeah, and you touched on some really, really important points that needed to be recognized within the work culture, like shifts or changes that needed to happen. And you also briefly mentioned that the Prime Minister had commented on it. And I was gonna ask that. So what was the reaction from the general public, but then also from colleagues or people that you had known following like going public with the lawsuit?
In terms of colleagues, what I heard, I wasn't in the office the day that it came out. I was on leave, and so were the others. But, you know, friends called and said that everyone at CSIS was glued to their screens, reading the extensive civil claim that was detailed in terms of the experiences that all the myself and the other officers had. Some of the things I heard back was, you know, this is CSIS. This has been who we are for so many years, and people couldn't argue with that. And so that was really refreshing to see. It was refreshing to see that so many people participated in the climate assessment. So 1/3 of the Toronto office participated. And I understand the culture of reprisal inside this organization. And so I was really pleased. I commented on the Toronto Star saying, you know, I'm really, really proud of my colleagues that came forward and spoke about this, not just in support of us, but in support of change. And so on the inside, I think there wasn't an acknowledgement at the highest level of the leadership. They acknowledged it publicly once that report came about. So in terms of politically as well, I think that we don't in Canada talk about national security issues in a way that we should. And so generating these discussions, I think, was important. What is really going on behind the doors of, you know, CSIS or the RCMP or global affairs? And I know, we've heard a lot about the RCMP, the sexual assault in the military, the $100 million lawsuits at the RCMP, in which many, many women have been impacted. So these things, you know, it's not only CSIS, it's pretty much all of national security organizations in Canada that suffer from this kind of culture, workplace culture that has been so problematic. And so there was, my group and I represented CSIS. And so government, I think at that time recognized that this is something that they need to really look at. And so the National Security Committee of Parliamentarians did a study on diversity in national security. And this was the report, what I believe is 2019. So just shortly after our case. And that report says that racialized people have been leaving the sector and that there's a lack of representation. They also talk about the value that people of different backgrounds can bring to this kind of work. You really, in my view, can't do intelligence work, security, intelligence, law enforcement, without having a demographic that is representative of the public, without understanding the issues at depth, that you can only have that if you have a diverse workforce. And I think a lot of the problems that CSIS ran into in terms of the lack of trust between CSIS and Muslim community and other communities as well is because of that lack of diversity. So if you have officers like me that can have those discussions with people in the community in a way that is sensitive, in a way that is, in support of the community, it builds trust, and it is so critical to the work that we do.
Yeah, and I think it's very clear that the lawsuit was a very important step in addressing structural and systematic issues of racism and discrimination, but you also did put a lot on the line with participating in the lawsuit. And I think you mentioned that your career at CSIS was almost 16 years, and so that's a pretty long time within a department. So I'm curious of how you kind of came to terms or grappled with the knowledge that participating in the lawsuit would essentially end your career with CSIS, and how you navigated that and were able to still move forward so boldly to be able to do that.
I had a choice. In 2017, when we launched the civil lawsuit, I had a choice. Prior to that, anytime I walked into CSIS, I felt like I was essentially communicating and saying to the organization, you can treat me less than equal, you can abuse me, I'm going to keep walking in. And so I had to take that stand of saying, no, you can't do that anymore, right? And it is really, really, problematic. Once you sue in a place of employment, it's really difficult to walk back into that environment. Not only is it triggering at so many levels, but it's, I think that, my work was done at CSIS with CSIS in that way. But I continue to challenge not only CSIS, but other national security organizations so that there is more diversity, so that there is that culture change. I provide support to others that come forward. So I don't know if you're aware, but there were two women that were sexually assaulted at CSIS that went public with their complaints about a month ago. So providing support to them and to others that come forward and shine a light to these kind of concerns. But in terms of even contributing internationally, I think that's an important contribution to diversify, to also get out there and talk about national security and inspire perhaps other racialized people to seek careers in national security. And be mindful. I wrote the book so that people go through my experience and learn from it, you know, what worked, what didn't, but also more importantly to the organization and to policymakers. And I know I've been given, I've been invited to speak at public safety, at the RCMP, at other places within national security. And so, you know, that conversation's ongoing, and I think it is really helpful so that, you know, leaders within the sector are aware what it's like, because some don't know. You know, some of this harmful kind of act is intentional, some of it is unintentional, and some of it is systemic because of how these organizations came to be, right? And so doing that, I think, is, you know, I thought that my role was fighting terrorism, but my role is now to make sure that I contribute to building stronger organizations that can tackle that threat.
Within that topic of building stronger organizations, what steps should departments or agencies like CSIS take to address issues of systemic and structural racism?
Oh, there's so much to be done. You know, looking at policies, processes, culture change, and really identifying systematically what the barriers are, where they've discriminated in the past, why people are leaving the sector. So conducting these kind of exit interviews to learn about what went wrong, talking to people on the inside. I know we have now networks. So we have Black employee networks, Muslim employee networks, and other networks that they need to tap into and understand the experiences of people, and then make sure that policies and procedures, operations are all being reviewed in that light, in that anti-racism and, you know, GPA plus, all of those things that have come to the forefront now and are really, really important in ensuring that we have these workplaces that are inclusive and where people can bring their authentic selves to the workplace. So these things are ongoing, but they're not, you know, it's not a half hour training course that's going to do the magic. That's what government has put in as mandatory. It takes problem solving. It takes anticipating that these things do occur on a regular basis, and the fact that we need to not place them in HR, but have it throughout what the organization does and in the way that it deals with sectors and partners. So there is a lot to do, but and I think those things are, you know, out there now. What is really missing is having that accountability measures in place. So that's really, really key if you want to keep the momentum. The momentum was really forced on us as a result of the, you know, very cruel murder of George Floyd. This is really when anti-racism became an issue here in the Canadian public sector. And as a result of the Black Class Action lawsuit, that's when government decided they're going to, in a serious way, tackle this. Before that, the Prime Minister had the Tiger Team on equity, diversity. And even the leaders in charge of this didn't show up. You know, equity laws were 30 years old. Nobody cared about it. It was these kind of issues. It was really forced on us. And so now there's been resources dedicated to fighting this. But we need to make sure that we are consistent and that there are these accountability measures. So, you know, you can't throw money on it. You can't just do training. You really have to have these accountability measures. And what I'm saying about that is that leaders, managers have to incorporate EDI initiatives within their performance evaluations? You know, have they been champions in a real way towards that, towards those goals? And what has been the change? So, you know, annually, has there been hiring of Indigenous, racialized women, people living with disability? Has the hiring increased? Are people staying? And what are the kind of the grievance processes do not work? I mean, that's very clear in terms of what the experience, you know, the fact that women were not going at the RCMP or the military. You know, we have Operation Honor that, you know, we trusted the military to take care of its own problems. The leadership itself was problematic and never took care of the issues. And so these grievance processes don't work in a culture that is these cultures within the national security field. So, you know, increasing, looking at those grievances and really doing a deep dive into how can we make them better and how can we provide support to people that are going through this. And linking mental health with discrimination, because it has a huge impact from personal experience, a huge, huge impact. So lots of work to do. And it's work that should be done by the community, by people that are impacted by this. And I'm not certain that that's happening.
Shifting now from your time at CSIS to your eventual run for public office federally in 2021, I'm curious as to what this transition was like. And I was actually talking to someone recently who was asking about whether people within the public service ran for MP or MPP positions and like why we didn't see that more often. So I'm just curious on what that was like going from the more private side of government to a more public facing role?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's a really good like 4-minute video that Global TV did. It's an interview that they did with me at the time, and it really demonstrates the contrast between a life in the security and intelligence world where, you know, no one knew who I am, nobody knew where I worked, and then going public, very public, and wanting, you know, going out there door to door, talking to people, and asking for their votes and their support in for the campaign. So really, really two, you know, opposites. And what I heard as well from people is that, you know, they've never thought that somebody from CSIS would be running for the New Democratic Party, because the culture within the security sector tends to be conservative, or, you know, maybe some that are liberal, but mostly conservative, traditional type of folks. And so that, I think, surprised a lot of people. I got a lot of questions on that front. But looking at the reasons I ran in terms of equity and national security, you know, it is really the NDP that was, that had the more progressive view on a lot of the things that I cared about. So that's why I went with the NDP. But also I went with the NDP because of my experience with the party itself. I had spoken with Jagmeet Singh and others and found that they get these issues that I'm talking about. And I felt that there would be support to some of the work that I would be doing as an MP. They also supported when we went, my group and I went public with the lawsuit. We had spoken to the national security critic, Matthew Dubay, who brought the issue up in Parliament as well. So lots of connections to the NDP. And there are others that have ran both provincial level and federal level that are former CSIS. However, they tend to not talk about that experience or identify that they were former officers. Part of it is because we are, as intelligence officers, are not You know, there's a law where I can't identify anybody who is CSIS. So I think a lot of them just, you know, go by public safety and don't talk about that experience. Because, I mean, what's the point once you go? I did in a big way because of the lawsuit and because I was talking about those issues. But for others, you know, you can't speak about what you did at work. So there's really no point in identifying yourself as former CSIS. So they tend to not do it. But there's at least four or five that I know that have also switched their careers and got into politics. I think it's something that comes naturally. We see it a lot in the US. After years of public service, I think that it is, you know, it is another way in which you can serve your country and continue to impact and make change.
And did you find that there were specific skills or general experiences from working in the public service that you were able to leverage, or that kind of aided you within the campaign run and talking to people and speaking to those in your writing?
Yeah, certainly. So as an intelligence officer, you know, you're really managing a project. So you have teams of, for example, surveillance or communication analysts, like foreign language interpreters, as well as science, those with scientific backgrounds, other support staff. So when you're running an operation as an officer, you are managing and leading diverse teams towards a goal. And I think that being a candidate, that's exactly what you're doing, is that, you know, you have volunteers that are doing or paid staff that are doing different work. So whether it's science, whether it's, you know, marketing, whether it's media interviews, you're doing a diverse things, dealing with diverse people, and managing sort of you ultimately as a candidate, you're responsible in the direction and the way in which your team goes. And so I think those skills served me really well. They were transferable. And also, of course, the people skills. So as an officer, you're trained to go and speak to people at all levels. So it could be a CEO, it could be somebody who is, you know, working class, middle class. Like, I mean, you're talking to different people all the time, new immigrants from at airports. And so, you know, that experience of just going, walking up to strangers, having a conversation, connecting with people at different levels, that helped as well, I think, tremendously, as well as dealing with complex issues. And so, you know, in the intelligence world, you have counterterrorism, counterintelligence, counterproliferation, screening. Those are the kind of big five things that CSIS does. And then you switch to politics, and you really, while I came in because of my national security expertise and equity concerns, I had to develop knowledge on climate change, on health issues, and you know, housing, immigration, like all these big issues that you need to really dive deep into and understand what, you know, where we're at and where we need to be. And be able to communicate that to the public in, you know, in media reports, in debates with other candidates. And so, you know, all of these things, I think, are skills that have been, you know, really useful to me in the intelligence world, but also valuable in the campaign that I ran.
And you mentioned that some of the key points that you were pushing forward had to do with, for example, EDI. But I'm wondering, like, what were some of your key goals during the election and if you were to be elected as MP?
Yeah, so change, really. I felt that, you know, in the riding of Ottawa South, which is a really diverse riding, we've had a a liberal representation, and one individual person who won 6 elections. So we have not had change in so many years, over a decade. It's going to be 2 decades. And I think that's problematic for democracy. I think that we need fresh perspectives. I think we need representation, more women and racialized people to get into politics. The climate, the political climate, is just as toxic as security climates. And more people, especially women, are pulling out. You know, we know, like, Catherine McKenna right here in Ottawa, being called climate Barbie and all this nonsense, right? And the mayor, just recently, the mayor of Gatineau, you know, stepped down as a result of that kind of toxic culture. And, you know, if we don't have women, racialized, other people coming into the table and being part of that political system, it will be, you know, do we have a democracy then, right? Like, really. And that's what, like, equity goes into politics as well in that way, right? Like, so yes, I came into it with this, but I discovered also that there are so many barriers for people to enter politics and to remain, to be able, and people are being, you know, this hostile kind of environment is not because people disagree with policy issues, but because of people's identities. And so I think we have an understanding that we've tackled those kind of issues long ago, but they're present here and really impacting so much what we do. Canada was, you know, on the democracy index was pretty high. It is not now, because of those kind of concerns. So Bill C-21 and other equity related issues are, you know, it's impacting our democracy. And so it's so critical. I, you know, I felt going into politics, and getting, raising the issue, at least, like, you may not win the election, but here we are, we're going to talk about it. And so when we had issues where somebody was taking down my signs because I'm a racialized woman, and we, you know, we called the police, the guy kind of admitted to this is why he was taking my signs and not the conservative, because he supported the liberals, but he wasn't taking it down down the conservative party's stuff. It was strictly mine. And the police didn't charge. We went to the BBC. We made a public, we made the issue public, not because, you know, I mean, that's a distraction from policy issues, and I didn't want that to happen, but I felt it was important to raise awareness that this is unacceptable. It shouldn't happen. And this is the experience of women and others that run into, that we run into as candidates, or women in politics.
Mm, yeah, definitely. And I believe I was in London at that time, or I'd just come back to Ottawa, but the same thing was happening in my riding, when I was university in London, with taking down signs, because we had a black female candidate running, and I know that she also dealt with the same things. So I know an election is definitely not easy. And your book, Agent of Change, came out last year in 2023, and curious to know what your goals and what your hopes were in writing this book, and also what your goals are for the future and what you're hoping to accomplish based off of the extensive and very diverse and dynamic experiences that you've had.
I really enjoyed writing Agent of Change. I go through, you know, my family's history in terms of escaping civil war, and then the barriers I faced in national security, my contributions, and getting that recognition in the UK for really impacting security at an international level. And so the book in itself has been really well received. We had coverage from, you know, different media outlets like the Hill Times, the Globe and Mail, and other newspapers, as well as interviews with CBC and others, right? So it really brought these issues to the forefront for public debate. And it's also on the CIA's website. So, you know, security officials in other countries are using my experience and example to talk about what it feels like, that imposter syndrome that people like me experience in national security. I think I had a high level CIA executive that reached out and said, hey, I did a book review of your book and it's on our website. So that was pretty cool. The book is also in, it is in the Spy Museum in Washington. I've been invited to speak in the UK at a number of universities and across Canada as well. You know, I've been to BC, Alberta. So all of these experiences, I think, have been, you know, so amazing. I'm so pleased and grateful for them. What I'm doing now is I work as an instructor at the University of Ottawa and teach national security and diversity, surprise, surprise. And the course is doing well. I'm enjoying, you know, continuing to connect with people in the field. And it allows me to follow the developments, what is happening, the changes that are occurring. I'm also working with the RCMP, looking at their EDI initiatives and providing recommendations as advisor. And so there is, you know, still a lot to do, and a lot of it is really impactful. And I'm really pleased about that. So
that's great, and congrats on your success. And I actually have a copy of the book right here that I'm gifting to a friend who is looking to have a possible career in national security. So it definitely is a book that has already, I'm sure, impacted so many people and will continue to do so. And so just want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I think a lot of the work that you've done and continue to do is really important. And just curious if you have any final words to leave us with or any final sentiments.
Yeah, thank you so much. That means a lot to me. And I think it's why I continue to do what I do and speak at universities and so on. What I want to leave you with is that, you know, the careers in national security are really, really amazing, not only because you're serving your country, but because the work itself as well is really interesting. And there's a lot of growth and opportunity that is available for people. Yes, you know, there are barriers, but, you know, people are pushing every day. And we are in a different era now that we are openly acknowledging all these problems that exist. And so it is a great time to join. So I, you know, always recommend to people to seek careers in national security, because that's what I was fighting for. That's a change that we want to see, and we're not going to see it if people are not getting in. And just final thought is, you know, I wouldn't have it any other way. I'm grateful for these things. Someone walked up to me as an RCMP officer and said, you know, there's a lot of pain. What do I do with that? Like, what do you do? And I thought, like, I think that makes us more conscious and real. It allows us to connect with people and have a deeper understanding of life. You know, it's such life experiences that I appreciate. And, you know, empathy goes a long way. Humility goes a long way. And these experiences really humble you. And I think we need more of that in the world. We need more empathy, more of that, and more like the courage to fight back and to be there for other people. So those are things that I've learned over the years, and I want to give it as a piece of advice to others that are in that sector. You know, be an ally for other people, because change doesn't it's not just women that are going to fight to have representation of women. It's not going to be just racialized people. We need everybody to be on the same page, on the same goals as everyone. So yeah, those are my final thoughts, and thank you for having me, and thanks to, you know, the entire team, and it's been great. So thank you.
A big thank you to Huda McBill for taking the time to chat with us on this episode. That's all from us today, and we'll catch you next time on Policy Talks.